An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine by John Henry Newman. Application of the Seven Notes to the Existing Developments of Christian Doctrine. Chapter 6. Application of the First Note of a True Development. Preservation of Type. Section 1. Now let me attempt to apply the foregoing seven notes of fidelity in intellectual developments to the instance of Christian doctrine. And first, as to the note of identity of type. I have said above that whereas all great ideas are found, as time goes on, to involve much which was not seen at first to belong to them, and have developments, that is, enlargements, applications, uses, and fortunes very various, one security against error and perversion in the process is the maintenance of the original type, which the idea presented to the world at its origin, amid and through all its apparent changes and vicissitudes from first to last. How does this apply to Christianity? What is its original type? And has that type been preserved in the developments commonly called Catholic, which have followed, and in the Church which embodies and teaches them? Let us take it as the world now views it in its age, and let us take it as the world once viewed it in its youth. And let us see whether there be any great difference between the early and the later description of it. The following statement will show my meaning. There is a religious communion claiming a divine commission and holding all other religious bodies around it heretical or infidel. It is a well-organized, well-disciplined body. It is a sort of secret society, binding together its members by influences and by engagements, which it is difficult for strangers to ascertain. It is spread over the known world. It may be weak or insignificant locally, but it is strong on the whole from its continuity. It may be smaller than all other religious bodies together, but is larger than each separately. It is a natural enemy to governments external to itself. It is intolerant and engrossing, and tends to a new modeling of society. It breaks laws. It divides families. It is a gross superstition. It is charged with the foulest crimes. It is despised by the intellect of the day. It is frightful to the imagination of the many, and there is but one communion such. Place this description before Pliny or Julian. Place it before Frederick II or Guizot. Apparent dire facies. Each knows at once, without asking a question, who is meant by it. One object, and only one, absorbs each item of the detail of the delineation. Section 1. The Church of the First Centuries. The prima facie view of early Christianity in the eyes of witnesses external to it is presented to us in the brief but vivid descriptions given by Tacitus, Suetonius, and Pliny, the only heathen writers who distinctly mention it for the first 150 years. Tacitus is led to speak of the religion on occasion of the conflagration of Rome, which was popularly imputed to Nero. "To put an end to the report," he says, "he laid the guilt on others, and visited them with the most exquisite punishment. Those, namely, who, held in abhorrence for their crimes, per flagitia invisos, were popularly called Christians. The author of that profession, Nominis, was Christ, who in the reign of Tiberius was capitally punished by the procurator Pontius Pilate. The deadly superstition, exitiabilis superstitio, though checked for a while, broke out afresh, and that not only through Judea, the original seat of the evil, but through the city also, whither all things atrocious or shocking, atrocia aut pudenda, flow together from every quarter and thrive. At first, certain were seized who avowed it. Then, on their report, a vast multitude were convicted, not so much of firing the city as of hatred of mankind. Odio humani generis. After describing their tortures, he continues, "In consequence, though they were guilty and deserved most signal punishment, they began to be pitied, as if destroyed not for any public object, but from the barbarity of one man." Suetonius relates the same transactions thus. Capital punishments were inflicted on the Christians, a class of men of a new and magical superstition, superstitionis novae et maleficae. What gives additional character to this statement is its context, for it occurs as one out of various police or sumptuary or domestic regulations which Nero made, such as controlling private expenses, forbidding taverns to serve meat, repressing the contests of theatrical parties, and securing the integrity of wills. When Pliny was governor of Pontus, he wrote his celebrated letter to the Emperor Trajan to ask advice how he was to deal with the Christians, whom he found there in great numbers. One of his points of hesitation was whether the very profession of Christianity was not by itself sufficient to justify punishment. Whether the name itself should be visited, though clear of flagitious acts, flagitia, or only when connected with them. He says he had ordered for execution such as persevered in their profession after repeated warnings, as not doubting whatever it was they professed, that at any rate contumacy and inflexible obstinacy ought to be punished. He required them to invoke the gods, to sacrifice wine and frankincense to the images of the emperor, and to blaspheme Christ, to which, he adds, it is said no real Christian can be compelled. Renegades informed him that the sum total of their offense or fault was meeting before light on an appointed day, and saying with one another a form of words, carmen, to Christ, as if to a god, and binding themselves by oath, not to the commission of any wickedness, but against the commission of theft, robbery, adultery, breach of trust, denial of deposits. That after this they were accustomed to separate, and then to meet again for a meal, but eaten all together, and harmless. However, that they had even left this off, after his edicts enforcing the imperial prohibition of heteriae, or associations. He proceeded to put two women to the torture, but discovered nothing beyond a bad and excessive superstition, superstitionem pravam et immodicam. The contagion, of which, he continues, had spread through villages and country till the temples were emptied of worshippers. In these testimonies, which will form a natural and convenient text for what is to follow, we have various characteristics brought before us of the religion to which they relate. It was a superstition, as all three writers agree, a bad and excessive superstition, according to Pliny, a magical superstition, according to Suetonius, a deadly superstition, according to Tacitus. Next, it was embodied in a society, and moreover, a secret and unlawful society, or hetaeria. And it was a proselytizing society. And its very name was connected with flagitious, atrocious, and shocking acts. Now, these few points, which are not all which might be set down, contain in themselves a distinct and significant description of Christianity. But they have far greater meaning when illustrated by the history of the times, the testimony of later writers, and the acts of the Roman government towards its professors. It is impossible to mistake the judgment passed on the religion by these three writers, and still more clearly by other writers and imperial functionaries. They evidently associated Christianity with the Oriental superstitions, whether propagated by individuals or embodied in a rite, which were in that day traversing the empire, and which, in the event, acted so remarkable a part in breaking up the national forms of worship, and so in preparing the way for Christianity. This, then, is the broad view which the educated heathen took of Christianity. And if it had been very unlike those rites and curious arts in external appearance, they would not have confused it with them. Changes in society are, by a providential appointment, commonly preceded and facilitated by the setting in of a certain current in men's thoughts and feelings in that direction towards which a change is to be made. And as lighter substances whirl about before the tempest and presage it, so words and deeds, ominous but not effective of the coming revolution, are circulated beforehand through the multitude, or pass across the field of events. This was specially the case with Christianity, as became its high dignity. It came heralded and attended by a crowd of shadows, shadows of itself, impotent and monstrous as shadows, but not at first sight distinguishable from it by common spectators. Before the mission of the apostles, a movement of which there had been earlier parallels had begun in Egypt, Syria, and the neighboring countries, tending to the propagation of new and peculiar forms of worship throughout the empire. Prophecies were afloat that some new order of things was coming in from the east, which increased the existing unsettlement of the popular mind. Pretenders made attempts to satisfy its wants, and old traditions of the truth, embodied for ages in local or in national religions, gave to these attempts a doctrinal and ritual shape, which became an additional point of resemblance to that truth which was soon visibly to appear. The distinctive character of the rites in question lay in their appealing to the gloomy rather than to the cheerful and hopeful feelings, and in their influencing the mind through fear. The notions of guilt and expiation, of evil and good to come, and of dealings with the invisible world, were in some shape or other preeminent in them, and formed a striking contrast to the classical polytheism, which was gay and graceful, as was natural in a civilized age. The new rites, on the other hand, were secret. Their doctrine was mysterious. Their profession was a discipline, beginning in a formal initiation, manifested in an association, and exercised in privation and pain. They were, from the nature of the case, proselytizing societies, for they were rising into power. Nor were they local, but vagrant, restless, intrusive, and encroaching. Their pretensions to supernatural knowledge brought them into easy connection with magic and astrology, which are as attractive to the wealthy and luxurious as the more vulgar superstitions to the populace. Such were the rites of Cybele, Isis, and Mithras. Such the Chaldeans, as they were commonly called, and the Magi. They came from one part of the world, and during the 1st and 2nd century spread with busy perseverance to the northern and western extremities of the empire. Traces of the mysteries of Cybele, a Syrian deity, if the famous temple at Hierapolis was hers, have been found in Spain, in Gaul, and in Britain, as high up as the Wall of Severus. The worship of Isis was the most widely spread of all the pagan deities. It was received in Ethiopia and in Germany, and even the name of Paris has been fancifully traced to it. Both worships, as well as the science of magic, had their colleges of priests and devotees, which were governed by a president, and in some places were supported by farms. Their processions passed from town to town, begging as they went and attracting proselytes. Apuleius describes one of them as seizing a whip, accusing himself of some offense, and scourging himself in public. These strollers, circulatores or agiotae in classical language, told fortunes and distributed prophetical tickets to the ignorant people who consulted them. Also, they were learned in the doctrine of omens, of lucky and unlucky days, of the rites of expiation and of sacrifices. Such an agiotes, or itinerant, was the notorious Alexander of Abinoticus, till he managed to establish himself in Pontus, where he carried on so successful an imposition that his fame reached Rome, and men in office and station entrusted him with their dearest political secrets. Such a wanderer, with a far more religious bearing and a high reputation for virtue, was Apollonius of Tyana, who professed the Pythagorean philosophy, claimed the gift of miracles, and roamed about preaching, teaching, healing, and prophesying from India and Alexandria to Athens and Rome. Another solitary proselytizer, though of an earlier time, and of an avowed profligacy, had been the Sacrificulus, viewed with such horror by the Roman Senate as introducing the infamous Bacchic rites into Rome. Such, again, were those degenerate children of a divine religion who, in the words of their creator and judge, compassed sea and land to make one proselyte, and made him twofold more the child of hell than themselves. These vagrant religionists, for the most part, professed a severe rule of life, and sometimes one of fanatical mortification. In the mysteries of Mithras, the initiation was preceded by fasting and abstinence, and a variety of painful trials. It was made by means of a baptism as a spiritual washing, and it included an offering of bread and some emblem of a resurrection. In the Samothracian rites, it had been a custom to initiate children. Confession, too, of greater crimes seems to have been required, and would naturally be involved in others in the Inquisition prosecuted into the past lives of the candidates for initiation. The garments of the converts were white. Their calling was considered as a warfare, militia, and was undertaken with a sacramentum, or military oath. The priests shaved their heads and wore linen, and when they were dead, were buried in a sacerdotal garment. It is scarcely necessary to refer to the mutilation inflicted on the priests of Cybele. One instance of their scourging has already been mentioned, and Tertullian speaks of their high priest cutting his arms for the life of the Emperor Marcus. The priests of Isis, in lamentation for Osiris, tore their breasts with pine cones. This lamentation was a ritual observance founded on some religious mystery. Isis lost Osiris, and the initiated wept in memory of her sorrow. The Syrian goddess had wept over dead Tammuz, and her mystics commemorated it by a ceremonial woe. In the rites of Bacchus, an image was laid on a bier at midnight, which was bewailed in metrical hymns. The god was supposed to die and then to revive. Nor was this the only worship which was continued through the night, while some of the rites were performed in caves. Only a heavenly light can give purity to nocturnal and subterraneous worship. Caves were at that time appropriated to the worship of the infernal gods. It was but natural that these wild religions should be connected with magic and its kindred arts. Magic has, at all times, led to cruelty, and licentiousness would be the inevitable reaction from a temporary strictness. An extraordinary profession, when men are in the state of mere nature, makes hypocrites or madmen, and will in no long time be discarded, except by the few. The world of that day, associated together in one company, Issiac, Phrygian, Mithriac, Chaldean, wizard, astrologer, fortune-teller, itinerant, and, as was not unnatural, Jew. Magic was professed by the profligate Alexander and was imputed to the grave Apollonius. The rites of Mithras came from the Magi in Persia, and it is obviously difficult to distinguish in principle the ceremonies of the Syrian Torobolium from those of the Necromantia in the Odyssey, or of Canidia in Horace. The Theodosian Code calls magic generally a superstition, and magic, orgies, mysteries, and sabbathizing were referred to the same barbarous origin. Magical superstitions, the rites of the Magi, the promises of the Chaldeans, and the Mathematici are familiar to the readers of Tacitus. The Emperor Otho, an avowed patron of Oriental fashions, took part in the rites of Isis and consulted the Mathematici. Vespasian, who also consulted them, is heard of in Egypt as performing miracles at the suggestion of Serapis. Tiberius, in an edict, classes together Egyptian and Jewish rites, and Tacitus and Suetonius, in recording it, speak of the two religions together as ea superstitio. Augustus had already associated them together as superstitions and as unlawful, and that in contrast to others of a like foreign origin. As to foreign rites, peregrinae ceremoniae, says Suetonius, as he paid more reverence to those which were old and enjoined, so did he hold the rest in contempt. He goes on to say that even on the judgment seat he had recognized the Eleusinian priests into whose mysteries he had been initiated at Athens. Whereas, when traveling in Egypt, he had refused to see Apis, and had approved of his grandson Caligula's passing by Judea without sacrificing at Jerusalem. Plutarch speaks of magic as connected with the mournful mysteries of Orpheus and Zoroaster, with the Egyptian and the Phrygian. And in his treatise on superstition, he puts together in one clause, as specimens of that disease of mind, covering oneself with mud, wallowing in the mire, sabbathizings, fallings on the face, unseemly postures, foreign adorations. Ovid mentions in consecutive verses the rites of Adonis, lamented by Venus, the Sabbath of the Syrian Jew, and the mephitic temple of Io in her linen dress. Juvenal speaks of the rites, as well as of the language and the music, of the Syrian Orontes, having flooded Rome, and in his description of the superstition of the Roman women, he places the low Jewish fortune-teller between the pompous priests of Cybele and Isis and the bloody witchcraft of the Armenian horospects and the astrology of the Chaldeans. End of part 1 of section 1 of chapter 6.